Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. This is part four of the Red Box Whip Round, a special mini-series of interviews going behind the scenes of the Whip's office. In this episode, I speak to Mark Harper, who in 2015 became the first chief whip in a Conservative majority government for 18 years. I joined him in his Commons office, where drinking out of his favourite Chief Whip mug, he insisted the job was nothing like House of Cards. I began by asking him if ensuring discipline was made easier by having a slim Tory majority, or if it was better when his party could rely on the Lib Dems to get their laws passed.
So Mark Harper, here we are in your rather nice office in the old part of the palace. You're drinking out of your Chief Whip mug. You were Chief Whip from when the Conservative majority government was formed, right through until Theresa May became Prime Minister. So, was that easier because it was a Tory majority?
In some ways, I think it was probably more difficult, certainly from observing it. One of the things with the coalition was, although there were the tensions, clearly, and differences of opinion between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats, actually, when we were delivering something that was in the coalition agreement, or something that wasn't where there was agreement, the government had a majority of 80.
Yeah.
And actually, on most occasions, if the opposition didn't get its act together, it was a majority closer to 100. So actually, except for those occasions when the two coalition parties fell out with each other, it was a pretty decent-sized majority. Obviously, going to a Conservative majority government, our majority was 12, our working majority was 16. And if all the opposition parties were against us, you know, it was actually quite a tough gig.
So explain to me, because some people will hear, well, the majority's actually 12 because the Tories have got 12 more seats than everyone else. Why is the working majority 16?
Basically because Sinn Féin don't take their seats, so they're never going to be here. They're technically opposition MPs and we don't hold those seats, but they're never here to vote against us, so the working majority is that little bit bigger.
And it seems to be this sense lately that majorities even higher. The DUP seem to be voting with the government more often than not. Labour Party in a bit of a mess, is that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of worst case scenario. I mean, clearly there are on issues, you know, people don't not to vote for you just because they don't happen to be Conservative. So as you've said, on issues, on a lot of issues, particularly issues to do with defence, security, the union, then we often will get the support of the DUP and the UUP. And if they both vote with us, are actually in our lobby, that actually increases our majority effectively by 20. Because you've got 10 opposition MPs actually voting with the government. If they don't vote with us, but they don't vote against us, that increases our majority by 10. So actually on issues where there isn't an argument for reaching out to opposition parties, and on some issues, of course, Labour doesn't have a consistent position, and the two most obvious ones of those, one when I was Chief Whip and one just afterwards, were on defence-related matters, where we got the support of a fair number of Labour MPs on the action in Syria.
Yep.
Last year, and obviously a lot of Labour MPs supported the renewal of Trident.
So how did you feel then? The Tories had just won a majority that nobody predicted. The Prime Minister calls you up and says, I'm going to give you a big promotion to the cabinet. You think terrific. And he says, I'm going to make you chief whip. What's your reaction to that?
Well, it was one of those interesting occasions where it was a Saturday morning, and I was just about to go to a meeting of my district council Conservative group, as you do, and the telephone rang, and it was absolutely throwing it down with rain, and I was sat in my parliamentary assistant's car in the car park, and the phone rang, and it was the Prime Minister. And in a funny sort of way, you got a hint about what the job might be because of when the phone call arrived. So he'd announced the most senior roles in cabinet, but hadn't announced any others. So in the nature of things,
chief whip was probably next.
Tends to get done fairly early on in the process. And I was actually very pleased because, notwithstanding the challenges, I'd spent a lot of time in Parliament. The previous jobs I'd done, particularly the constitutional reform job, I am a bit of a parliamentary person. I love Parliament, and so actually I couldn't actually think of anything better than a job which required you to kind of get the nuts and bolts to work for the government. The downside, of course, is you don't get to say anything in Parliament, and traditionally you don't do any broadcast media, but equally you get a ringside, literally a ringside seat when all the big events are taking place in Parliament, with a sort of guaranteed seat on the front bench. So it's sort of, you know, it swings and roundabouts.
But it's one of those weird jobs because you are very senior in the government and yet you never speak publicly. There was talk when Michael Gove got the job about he would become also sort of Minister for the Today programme. It never really sort of panned out like that. Do you think it's just because it needs to be a job sort of done behind closed doors?
Yeah, I do. It is one of those jobs. I think because you're involved to some extent, and I said I don't know whether this is the model that present Prime Minister has carried on, but certainly when I was doing the job, you know, you were involved in a lot of those decisions, and I think it's better if you're not doing a front of house job, because frankly the only thing you're going to get asked about are all the sort of things that are probably not the sort of things best talked about in public. You know, it's not your responsibility to be selling the policy or setting out the policy. That's for the cabinet minister that's responsible. If it's a big across government issue, you know, that responsibility would probably fall to the Prime Minister.
So when you're in those conversations, to what extent are you saying I think this is a good policy or a bad policy, or to what extent are you saying we're not going to get this through, or this is going to be tough?
Well, I think the mistake people always make about the whip's office generally and the chief whip's job is they always tend to look at it from the half of the job that's the transmit part of the job, which is to, you know, you are responsible for getting the government's programme, working with the Leader of the House of Commons, getting the government's programme through Parliament. But what people always forget is that you also have a receive job, as it were, which is to listen to the views of colleagues in the House of Commons, not just Conservative colleagues, but actually also to be mindful of where there's support for the government's policies on the opposition benches, not necessarily on the official opposition benches, but certainly on some of the smaller parties, and then give the Prime Minister an honest view about the support for that policy in Parliament. And actually, if you're doing your job properly, you should have been both parts of that, and working out when you should have an argument and a fight about something, even if you can't be guaranteed success, is worth it. And sometimes it's not worth it, and sometimes you need to listen to people and listen to their concerns, and you have to do both parts of that job. You can't really do either of those parts of the job completely in public.
And what was your experience of doing it? What were the sort of highs and lows? You know, what's a good day in the whip's office? What's a bad day?
Well, I suppose if I was looking at it, I suppose the low, which wasn't specifically a parliamentary moment, as it were. For me, the low was the referendum result, because, frankly, I worked very closely with David Cameron. He was leader for most of the time I was an MP, and in the ministerial jobs I had, I worked quite closely with him, and obviously latterly, as I was chief whip, very closely working with him. And I thought it was a huge loss that he had to stand down as Prime Minister. I mean, I think he was right to do so, given the result, and he judged it to be right to do so, and I think he saw clearly the import of the decision that had been made a lot more clearly, frankly, than other people did. I think it was right the parliamentary party, clear majority, wanted him to stay and had signed a letter accordingly, but I think he saw that it was necessary for him to step down. But I thought, given all the transformation that he'd led in the party and its prospects, taking us from when I first got elected in 2005, when we'd, you're both happy that you got elected, but the Labour Party was still in government, to actually having the first majority Conservative government for two decades, I thought was a huge achievement. So that was, I suppose, the low. As it happens, of course, we, notwithstanding the rules, the Parliamentary Party set out a very clear choice, chose a new Prime Minister who's clearly across the job, a huge amount of experience. I work very closely with her in the Home Office, so, you know, couldn't have chosen a better person to replace David Cameron. But notwithstanding that, I think he was it was a huge loss. The big success, I think, was actually getting the House, it was relatively modest in one sense, was getting the House to support extending the military action in Syria against Islamic State, Daesh, something that we hadn't done in the vote had been lost in 2013. And I think it was important, it moved things in the right direction. Perhaps if, you know, the House had taken a more decisive decision in 2013, we wouldn't be where we are today. But I think that was a really important decision that was going to have really important consequences, and we worked really hard across Parliament and got a very decisive action to give our military very clear steer and permission to do what was necessary to keep us safe.
What sort of whip were you? There's a sort of caricature, sort of Francis Urquhart. He's the ultimate chief whip operator in Westminster. And there are other people who say, well, now it's more of a sort of HR job, and you know, it's not giving, you know, twisting people's arms, it's, you know, carefully explaining and trying to coerce. But how far down the road of gentle persuasion do you go before you just say you are going to vote for this, aren't you?
Well, it's very interesting. I'm enormously grateful to Michael Dobbs for writing The House of Cards, because when anyone ever says, what's it like being a whip, you can usually avoid the question by talking about one of the characters, either from the Francis Urquhart British version, or you can do the more contemporary US version with Francis Underwood. And I can point out I've never had to push a journalist off a building or push one
that we know of,
or push one under a train, which is good news for you, or even, given where we're sat in our office, push you into the river. No, my view is, given where Parliament now is and given the changes that took place in the 2010 Parliament in terms of reducing, you know, the power of the office, you know, we elect select committee chairs now and parties elect members to go on the select committees, and also I think MPs are now much more focused on, there's a lot more information going backwards and forwards with constituents. I mean, there's a fantasy that in the past MPs were terribly independent and rebelled all the time and so forth. Actually, that's simply not true. In the 50s, you know, MPs voted with the whip pretty much all the time. MPs have become more rebellious, and I think it's a very good book that Philip Cowell is
reading, which sets all the revolts. That out. Yeah, yeah.
And I think, frankly, you've got to take people with you. You've got to remind colleagues the basis on which they were elected. You know, we were all elected on the same manifesto. What we promised we would do. And, you know, of course people are going to have varying levels of commitment to different things. You know, everyone does not agree with everything to the same extent. But it's about saying to people, this is a team approach. If you want to deliver the package of things we promise to do, there will be things you're keener on and things you're less keen on. But if everyone doesn't support the package, you can't deliver it. And you've also got to be able to listen to their concerns, make sure they have the opportunity to talk to ministers. Ministers then have to have the ability to flex what it is they're doing to maximise the support they're going to get amongst their parliamentary colleagues. And ultimately, we've all got to be comfortable that we can go back to our constituents and we can stand on a door. And even if it's a difficult decision, and I would want to be able to be confident that I could explain to someone why I did it. And, you know, all the way through the difficult decisions we were taking in the last Parliament on public expenditure reductions, you know, actually I was confident on those occasions I could go back and say to someone, look, even if you don't like this, this is why we're doing it, this is why it's necessary. And ultimately, colleagues have got to be able to do that. You can't expect them to go back and sell something to their constituents if they don't think it's the right thing to do, looking at the government's programme as a whole. And I think it's there's more of that involved nowadays in terms of taking people with you. And there's also a very important function, you alluded to that by talking about HR, a very important function about making sure colleagues are well supported. You know, colleagues get ill, You know, we've had a number of MPs be very open and honest about having mental health challenges, just like everyone else. One in four members of the public is going to have a mental health problem. MPs are not immune from that. It's making sure we look after people like you would expect a modern 21st century employer to do, and make sure people are properly looked after and can do their jobs properly and look after their constituents. And I think the WHIPS office is all of those things wrapped into one.
Is there such a thing as the little black book, the WHIPS book of misdemeanours that might be used against MPs?
No, there isn't. I mean, one of the
things... Oh, disappointing.
No, there really isn't. One of the things when I became chief whip, I mean, there just isn't.
Yeah.
And in fact, in the modern world, if you ever became aware that somebody had ever engaged in something that was a criminal matter, then your advice to someone that knew about that would be to report it to the police. And, you know, I just don't think in the modern world the sorts of things that are alleged to have taken place in the past, I have no idea whether they're true, I just don't think would be things that, that you would do. And I think there's, it's a much more modern style of whipping. But I think you have to treat colleagues, I think if you talk to MPs, you in your job will talk to lots of MPs around the place. I don't think the things that may have happened in the past, I just don't think they would work the same. Apart from anything else, given that we're discussing this and it's going out on a podcast, I think people need to think about modern communication methods like Twitter. If some of the things that may have happened in the past, you tried them now, you'd be reading about them on Twitter in 5 minutes, which would reduce their effectiveness. So I think in the modern world, I would say it's about reminding people they're part of a team, that we stood on a platform, that we all said to the public, if you elect us as Conservative MPs, you're going to get a Conservative government, and that government is going to do certain things. And it's about making sure, even when it's difficult, we all stick together and deliver the things that we promised.
Other whips I've spoken to have talked about the drinks cabinet playing an important role in either, you know, persuading people or celebrating a good result, or occasionally drowning sorrows when things go bad. What did you have in your drinks cabinet?
Well, I think it's fair to say I think I'm probably a wine person. I hasten to add, not paid for by the taxpayer, paid for by out of our own pocket. But I think, yes, just like in any job, if something goes well, you might have an occasional tipple to celebrate a job well done, and sometimes when things don't go well, you might have a tipple to drown your sorrows. But I think probably no more actually than in any sort of job where, you know, your people are working hard and trying to do a good job for the country.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
What difference do you think it makes that even when you were doing it, the sort of the problem for the chief whip, if you like, came from the Eurosceptic side of the Tory party? It was actually the Eurosceptic side are quite happy at the moment, and actually the sort of rebellious wing, if you like, are the Remainers. Is that a big shift for the way that the Tory party and the WHIPS office operates, do you think?
It's certainly fair to say, and I don't think it's giving away any particular secrets, to say that there were a number of issues that, if they had anything to do with Europe, there were a group of colleagues who were very Eurosceptic, who often were more difficult to persuade to support the government's position. I think that's not a particular secret, and they'd probably be quite proud to tell you who they were. And clearly that has changed somewhat since the referendum result, and we've been very clear. I was on the Remain side of the argument, but I am a first and foremost a Democrat, and I absolutely accept the decision, support the Prime Minister's determination to get the best deal for the country. And I do get slightly irritated by people who don't seem to be able to work out that we passed the legislation, we said that the decision was for the public. It said in the book we sent to everybody's house that the government would implement the decision, and now people are sort of trying to cavil at the answer. And I'm very clear we need to deliver that for people. But clearly the dynamic has changed, and there's now going to be a very interesting process where we're going to have to work really hard. And I think the Prime Minister set that out well in the cautious way that she conducts business, about trying to take everybody with us to deliver the result of that referendum. And clearly there are going to be some people in the parliamentary party who want to go further in one direction. There are going to be people on the other side who want to have a different outcome, and the challenge is going to be to take everybody with us as we go on that journey over the next couple of years to deliver what the British people voted for.
If you were still Chief Whip, would you be advising the Prime Minister to have an election? Actually, there are tough times ahead. 12 or 16 or whatever it is, majority isn't great. There are big votes probably coming around Brexit, if even not on the subject of it. Do you think there is a case for trying to increase that majority?
Well, one of the things I find slightly frustrating is how this debate about should there or shouldn't be early election is slightly missing the point, because as the minister who took the fixed-term parliaments...
Oh, you're to blame, of course.
The Prime Minister actually doesn't have the ability to call an early election. So, to some extent, whether she should or shouldn't have one is slightly beside the point.
But if she wanted to, ways could be found, couldn't they?
I'm not sure it's as straightforward as people think it is. I mean, either two-thirds of MPs have got to vote for an election, and that has to mean people actively voting for it, not just not voting against it. And it seems to me, given the opinion poll lead we have, and the view that many Labour MPs might have about their personal prospects, I'm not sure two-thirds of MPs would actually vote for an election today. If that doesn't happen, the only other way of having one is the government then has to go through this rather painful process of having a vote of confidence in itself, losing it. Then you have a two-week period where you know no other person can form a government, and then you have an election. My own view is I don't think that going into an election having just lost a vote of confidence, even if you'd explain to the public how that would come about, is the greatest platform on which to do it. Mechanically, I don't think, when everyone talks about should Theresa May have a snap election, she simply doesn't have the ability to have a snap election.
And it's your fault.
And you can argue, but what I was actually doing was delivering the coalition agreement.
Very good, yeah.
And delivering something, of course, most of my colleagues, not all of them, but most of my colleagues, of course, voted for it.
Were you disappointed not to have got a big job in her cabinet when she formed the government?
Well, I've always been very clear. I think when you elect a leader of the party, they have an absolute right to choose their team. After all, part of the reason why you elect them is because you think you trust their judgment.
Yeah.
And I've always been very clear. Politics is a team game. It's not an individual sport, using that analogy, and I made it clear that I was going to return to the backbenches but absolutely support the government from the backbenches, and all my interventions and comments since I've been very supportive of what the government's trying to do. And I'm also, as I said at the beginning of this interview, I love Parliament, so actually there is no better thing for me than being in the chamber, being able to speak, make those arguments, and to argue your case. So I'm very much enjoying doing that from the backbenches, and I will continue to do so for the rest of the Parliament.
And who knows, that call might come in a rainy car park again.
Well, it does seem to be my want to get those phone calls at funny times. But no, I mean, look, who she has in her government is entirely a matter for her. And I'm a one thing you do become when you've been Chief Whip and you've worked in the Whip's office is you are a team player. And politics is a team game. It's about everybody doing what they're asked to do, looking at how they can deliver what the public voted us in to do. And, you know, whatever role you're asked to take on is trying to do that to your best of your ability. And I think I enjoy participating in Parliament and raising issues there, and I'll continue to do so for as long as my constituents are happy to keep returning me here.
Of course, the Chief Whip isn't part of the royal household, but your deputies were. What sort of role do they play? How do you rely on them?
It's very interesting because the Whip's office, of course, stems from the link with the royal household is, of course, from the days when the job of the office was to get the king's money for fighting wars, basically. So yes, so the Chief Whip is official title is Parliamentary Secretary to the Treasury. So there's sort of the getting the permission for the money. But no, the other members of the office are actually members of the royal household. So on when there are garden parties, the deputy chief whip, who's the treasurer of the royal household, and there's the comptroller, who was the number three in the office when I was there, and the vice chamberlain, all go to those garden parties, wear their tails and frocks as appropriate. So my deputy was Anne Milton, who's still the deputy chief whip, and look after the Queen and other members of the royal family. But they actually have some roles formally as well. So the vice chamberlain is the person who, when the Queen comes to Parliament to do the state opening, is the official hostage. So to ensure the Queen is safely returned to the palace, the vice chamberlain, which was Chris Hopkins when I was chief whip, goes to the palace and has a sweet sherry, I think, with one of the senior royal courtiers, and is only allowed to come back to Parliament when Her Majesty is safely returned. But he also has the important role every day of writing the Queen a message about what's been going on in Parliament, so she takes a very close personal interest. There's some factual stuff about what was the business and what happened, but part of the vice chamberlain's job is to add a little bit of colour, a little bit of human interest to that message. I have no idea what were in those messages. Those are very much between the vice chamberlain and the Queen, but my understanding is the Queen gets those messages every day, she reads them and appreciates some of that little bit of colour and human side of things that's added, you know, that the vice chamberlain, a little bit of humour, a little bit of what may have been going on. And on days when there's a big important decision being taken, you get a little bit of the sense of the drama and the importance of some of the decisions, and that will obviously go with all of the important documents of state that she sees every day. So there's quite an interesting link between the whip's office, the government and the royal household, just reminding us, of course, that the crown is very much part of Parliament. There are two houses of Parliament, but the Queen has to sign all legislation, and the Crown has a very important role here.
And is it just a one-way process? The message goes from the whip's office to the palace. Does anything ever come back? Is there any feedback?
I don't. The honest answer is I don't know, because actually the vice chamberlain's sort of interactions with the Queen remain confidential. I don't know. But actually, in one sense, those jobs, particularly the vice chamberlain's job, I think was a huge privilege for the person that gets to do the job, because there are not very many roles in politics where you get the opportunity. I certainly never did. I think the Prime Minister is really the only other person where you get the opportunity to go and see the Queen one-on-one, nobody else in the room, where you take her official messages from Parliament and then you get to take the official responses. And there are not very many people in the world who get private time to talk to the sovereign without anybody else in the room, and I can only imagine that that would be a huge privilege for a Member of Parliament to do, and something which, you know, just makes this job even more interesting than all of the things we do on a day-to-day basis. And I know all the people that I've ever come across that have done that job have found it hugely fascinating.
Mark Harper, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Catch every episode in the Red Box Whip Round by subscribing to the podcast on your Android device and on iTunes, where it'd be great if you could leave a review. And for daily insight behind the scenes on life in Westminster, sign up to my morning email briefing at thetimes.co.uk/redboxemail. But for now, for me, Matt Shawley, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.